The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Welcome back one more time to the reading of the August 2023 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. We talked about Chimney Rock, the mountaintop experience, and 15 places for a family reunion. Today I'm going to start with an article entitled, We've Come This Far by Faith. For nearly two centuries, pilgrims have traveled from across the state to a 50-acre plot of land in Lincoln County for prayer and fellowship, at what some say is the oldest camp meeting in the country. Written by Tim Funk. Every August they come, young and old, from near and far, for 2 weeks of Christian fellowship and worship and front porch meetings. Their destination? Rock Spring Campground, 26 miles up the road from Charlotte in the Lincoln County community of Denver. It is the oldest continuing camp meeting in North Carolina and, some say, in the country. Each person in this vast cast of characters has a story to tell about their passion for this 50-acre plot that's been drawing people since 1830. When a group of Methodists paid $90 for the land and named it after the spring that supplied water for them and their animals. Among the storytellers, Pinky Taylor. She attended her first camp meeting here in 1940 when she was 6 weeks old. In the 83 years since then, Taylor, who grew up on a cotton farm nearby, has returned each year but one. In 1948, when a polio scare canceled the event. When I was a kid coming up, camp meeting was all we had to look forward to, she says. Mama and Daddy always called it our vacation. Now it's like a home and a church away from home. In 2014, Taylor's granddaughter, Courtney, got married at the Arbor, the open-air tabernacle that sits at the center of the campground. Perhaps the most arresting sight at Rock Spring, though, are the rows of unpainted, weather-beaten wooden cabins that still house Taylor and the other pilgrims during their annual sojourn. From a distance, the cabins suggest a stark 19th-century frontier settlement, but up close, those old-timey tents, successors to the actual canvas and brush tents in which many of the attendees' ancestors once stayed, are lovingly decorated with family pictures, framed Bible passages, porch swings, and rocking chairs that get a workout during visits with family. Taylor now lives only a 5-minute drive from Rock Spring, but she still spends the entire 2 weeks of camp meeting in tent 131. It's in the same spot as the one that her father, Joe, bought for $50 before she was born. When a fire in the 1970s destroyed it, Taylor and her family rebuilt. Now she's added Bible-inspired signs to the front porch that read, Love always, listen, and forgive and forget. And she spends much of her time during camp meeting catching up with her Rock Spring neighbors while sitting in the same rocking chair that her mother, Ruth, favored at past gatherings. Everybody tells me I look just like her, Taylor says. None of the more than 250 tents at Rock Spring have air conditioning. But instead of driving or walking back home on those long summer nights to sleep in her cooled-down house, Taylor stays put, relying on 5 fans that she's installed in her tent. "Well, camp meeting ain't at my home," she explains. "I need to be where the action is." She's got that right. Rock Spring comes alive every August during Little Week, the partial week prior to the main activities, and Big Week. Folks staying on these hallowed grounds make new memories with old friends, hold family reunions, cheer on a kid's parade, and ponder daily sermons. They spend lazy afternoons recalling the highlights of past camp meetings, the homemade ice cream, the water fights, the Methodist hymnals, and the precious time spent with parents and grandparents who have since gone on to their heavenly reward. Rock Spring isn't the only camp meeting in Lincoln County. There's also Tucker's Grove, founded by formerly enslaved people in 1874. It's still mostly African American, and Rock Spring is still mostly white, though guest black preachers and black choirs have been part of some of the services at the Arbor. Both Spring Rock and Tucker's Grove are on the National Register of Historic Places, and both prize the generations that came before. There's no other place where I can walk the same paths that my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, and my great-great-grandfather walked, says 63-year-old Jay Sigmund, who may be the hardest working man at Rock Spring during the camp meetings. He rings the bell for worship services and leads about 100 children in prayer before rewarding them with fistfuls of double bubble gum. He chauffeurs elderly folks around the site in a golf cart and sings his camp meeting ballad during Sunday gatherings. He even serves on the campground's 10-member board of trustees. Butch Ross, who chairs that board, also wears several hats. For starters, he leads Sunday school at the Arbor, where he always asks the Lord for a special blessing on this place. The 65-year-old Ross, who coaches the state champion wrestling team at West Lincoln High School, can trace his family's Rock Spring connections back to the 19th century, too. His great-grandfather, Warren Pa Beatty, was born in 1865 and was introduced to camp meetings that same year. Then there's 77-year-old Terry Brotherton, Rock Spring's unofficial historian. He's compiled 2 books about the campground and, like Sigmund, Ross, and Taylor, is a lifelong attendee. "I think it gets in your blood as a child," Brotherton says, "and every year is a reunion, a homecoming." Those who attend camp meeting nowadays don't show up in covered wagons or bring cows and chickens with them as many did 200 years ago. Back then, it was a place for evangelistic services that grew many people who lived far away from churches. They'd travel for days to sleep in tents just for the opportunity to gather for the prayer, sing hymns, and hear preaching by circuit-riding clergy. The wooden tents have added a few modern touches since then. They may not have air conditioning, but they do have bathrooms and refrigerators. Some of the older camp meeting regulars remember a time of late-night sprints to the outhouse and trucks delivering big blocks of ice. Still, much of the campground's appeal is in its old-time look, its ambience, and its traditions that remain anchored in a simpler, less hectic past, when early August was a time for cotton farmers in Lincoln County to relax between planting and harvesting. "We now live in a fast-paced world," says the Reverend Billy Towery, a United Methodist minister who's led the preaching at Rock Spring since 2019. "We have more technology than ever to connect people, yet we seem to be more isolated because of our busy schedules. Camp meetings bring people together where for 2 weeks they visit with each other." He pauses, and we come together for worship where we can sense the presence of the Lord. At the heart of the campground is the Arbor, which was built in 1832, making it as old as some cathedrals. Looking around the unadorned worship space, it's easy to imagine those original yeoman farmers here in the 1800s bowing their heads in prayer or being gripped by the Spirit at the moment of conversion. The arbor has no walls, but there's a tin roof, rough wooden columns, an old rugged cross hanging above the pulpit, and a floor covered with straw. Besides the weddings held here every summer, there are funerals too, where a bit of straw is traditionally placed inside the caskets. The piney pews, supplied with stacks of traditional Methodist hymnals, can seat 1,000 people. At the start of the big week, twice that many worshipers sit just outside the tent's perimeters in lounge chairs and on blankets, echoing ancestors who sang what some call the national anthem of camp meeting. Love lifted me, love lifted me, when nothing else could help, love lifted me. The wooden tents that line the campground's lanes are owned by families that typically pass them down from one generation to the next. The structures are rarely sold, but when they are, they can fetch as much as $60,000. Their rough exteriors and modest dimensions have led some passerbys to mistake them for horse sheds, an observation that some at Rock Spring share with a chuckle. Ellis McIntosh, a retired Denver truck driver who got engaged to his wife Linda outside one of the tents in 1968, says that the first time the couple brought guests to camp meeting, the reaction was classic. They said, "I see where the livestock stays. Where do the people stay?" Most of the tent owners appear to cherish their abodes, enhancing their porches with flowers, swings, a sandbox in one case, and signs that welcome or tickle the funny bone. "Sleeping porch," one reads. "God, family, and sweet tea," another declares, begging to be read with a southern accent. At tent 149, owned by J. Sigmund's family, the front porch swing is outfitted with a cushy seat from a 1949 Nash car. "My dad made this," Sigmund says. "Inside his tent, he dines at a picnic table. In a poem he wrote about camp meeting, Sigmund rhapsodizes about his favorite part of tent life, a slow rain on a tin roof when sleep comes a-calling." Rock Spring historian Brotherton has turned tent 107 into a museum. Its walls are lined with photos from camp meetings going back to 1910. In one, somebody's great-grandfather is doing the rusty, a form of buck dancing to fiddle-based music. And hanging from the ceiling are bucolic relics from the early decades, a horse collar, a lantern, a corn sheller, a cast-iron skillet. "I get a lot of traffic in here," Brotherton says. "It all brings back a lot of memories." Brotherton is the go-to source for a tutorial on camp meeting vocabulary. Like calaboose, the name of the jail when the campground had its own police force, or using tent as a verb, as in, "Will you be tenting at camp meeting this year?" On the front porch of tent 131, Pinky Taylor and her friends are laughing and shaking their heads at memories of past camp meetings. Back when mischievous kids would hurl rocks onto the roofs of tents in the wee hours. That would drive poor Mama crazy. She'd be off in her nightgown hollering at them, Taylor remembers. Daddy would tell her, "If you just lie down and be quiet, they'll leave you alone." It's family time in tent 127. Butch Ross and his extended brood are inside dining on fried chicken, country green beans, and homemade apple crisp. Grandchildren Katie Willis and Chance Norman, both 21 and both from Lincolnton, discuss what has become an increasing force, or rather a focus, among the trustees in recent years, the future of camp meeting. Specifically, will young people continue to show up at a time when there are so many distractions? Willis, a student at Appalachian State University, is a definite yes. It's very important, she says. I grew up here, and I want my future kids to grow up here. Norman isn't sure whether he'll stay the whole 2 weeks when he gets older. I like getting away from the technology, he says, but there aren't many people my age here. For Ross, feelings about camp meeting run deep. He tells the story of his father, Gene, who, after a lifetime of attending camp meeting, was diagnosed with cancer in 2011. By the following year, they both knew that he had little time left. Gene asked his son to take him on what Ross calls his last ride. Their first stop in Ross's red Chevrolet truck was the family farm, with its pasture of 75 beef cattle. Then his father wanted to go by Bob's Superette, a Lincoln County general store owned by a friend. The final stop, Rock Spring Campground. Ross steered his truck near the arbor, his father too ill to get out and walk up to the familiar place of worship, just silently gazed on it. 20 minutes passed. "This is it," his father said. "Take me home." A week later, Gene Ross died. Never came back out of the house, his son says. He went to the big camp meeting. Rock Spring Camp Meeting is at 6831 Campground Road in Denver, North Carolina. They have a website, Rock Springs, campmeeting.com. And now, peace and the Uwaris. On one joy-filled Sunday every August, a quiet church comes to life. There, descendants of two African-American families celebrate the shared heritage that dates to a 19th-century Randolph County community rooted in faith and bound by family ties. Written by Mark Kemp. Half a mile down a dusty gravel road, deep in the rolling hills of Uwari National Forest near Ashboro, sits a little country church. On most days, it's so still and quiet in the 6-acre clearing that you can hear the flutter of birds' wings and the cracks of breaking branches in the oak trees at the edge of the small cemetery. Marking the graves are weathered stones, some dating back more than a century, inscribed with names like Lassiter, Hill, Smithman, and Laughlin. On this Sunday in late August, though, Strivey Congregational United Church of Christ is jumping. It's homecoming weekend, and about 50 people are packed in the fellowship hall just steps away from the sanctuary. Loud voices bounce off brick and wood-paneled walls as extended family members scoot from table to table, hugging, kissing, and catching up on all the comings and goings since last year's gatherings. Births, graduations, marriages, deaths. Jerry Laughlin, 76 years old and looking Cab Calloway stylish in pleated charcoal pants and a lilac dress shirt unbuttoned at the top, presides over a spread of fried chicken, green beans, stewed cabbage, yams, rolls, and peach cobbler. "We've been cooking for this event for at least 10 years, maybe more," Jerry says, smiling warmly at the familiar faces lined up for second helpings. "We lived in Charlotte for a while, but even then we always came back for the homecoming." He motions to the woman dishing out the cobbler. "This is my wife, Jaxine," he says, and she winks. She's the sister of Don Simmons, the beloved owner of Magnolia 23 in Ashboro, one of the most popular Southern-style restaurants in Randolph County. Jerry occasionally helps out there, too. "It's all in the family," he says with a chuckle. Jerry's roots in this area run much deeper than 10 years or even 50. Like many of those surrounding him today, he's a descendant of the Lassiters of the nearby community of Lassiter's Mill. Others are descendants of Hills, who lived right here in Strebe, a once vibrant village that began life as Hilltown. In the late 1800s, the Lassiters and the Hills became part of a combined faith community that's been coming to this church every fourth Sunday in August for the past 141 years. Founded more than a decade before the start of the Civil War, Hilltown was a rare mixed community of free African Americans and some white people, mostly abolitionist Quakers, all living together in peace. In 1883, it was renamed Strybe by Isley Walden, a partially blind poet and one-time resident of Lassiter's Mill. Formerly enslaved with an extraordinary mathematical mind, Walden had worked as a mule driver in a Uwari gold mine before leaving North Carolina in 1867, 2 years after the Civil War ended, and walking all the way to Washington, D.C. While there, he attended Howard University and, later, in New Jersey, the New Brunswick Theological Seminary. In 1879, by then an ordained minister with a passion for educating black children, Waldron returned to the southwestern Randolph County, where he built a plank church and school and a post office to serve the people of Hilltown and parts of Matt Lassiter's Mill. He renamed Hilltown in honor of abolitionist M.E. Strybe, the American Missionary Association's corresponding secretary for foreign missions. Growing up in this area in the 1850s, Jerry wasn't aware of the rich history surrounding Strybe when he and his brother and sister would play together in the pews between Sunday school classes and the main service. Nobody did, really. Oh, there were some newspaper articles, and Jerry remembers hearing Walden's name spoken from time to time. But I didn't know much about him, he says. I knew that he founded the church and that he was buried out there in the cemetery. It wasn't until a historian and a genealogist from Maryland began digging into her own family's history that a clearer picture of Strybe began to emerge. Margot Lee Williams had been researching an ancestor, Miles Lassiter, who owned about 400 acres of farmland in this part of North Carolina. When she started out, she had no clue that her sleuthing would uncover the existence of a self-sustaining black community in Reconstruction-era Randolph County. The story was, free African Americans were living here, she says, and they had a successful school and church, and they were farmers, and they owned their property, and they got along with their white neighbors. She laughs. It's kind of hard to explain to people, she says with a shrug. They look at you a little weird, and they want to make certain assumptions about race relations. And I'm like, that just isn't how it was here. The people in this particular area simply got along. They were coexisting. They were helping each other with their crops. After visiting the area with her mother in 1982, Margot grew close to her newfound family members and began regularly making the six-hour drive down from Maryland each summer for the Strybe homecoming. She eventually wrote a book about Miles Lassiter and another about Strybe, and then a third about Isley Walden. Her presence in the community over the past 40 years, Jerry says, has brought an already close-knit group of rural families even closer. She's done an excellent job, he says. We've learned so much from her. The homecoming is a joyous affair. People arrive from across North Carolina, Raleigh, Greensboro, Fayetteville. They come from out of state, New York, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C. One works for Homeland Security, another Albert Lassiter was recently the interim president of Randolph Community College. But it's a rare gathering these days, except for this one weekend in August. Strybe Congregational United Church of Christ typically sits silent. In the 13 years since Jerry and Jaxine packed up their home in Charlotte and moved back here, they've seen attendance at regular services slow from a trickle to a drip. We can't even afford to have a preacher come in and preach to just two or three people, Jerry laments. But I know what the Lord said, for where two or three are gathered together in my name, I'm in the midst of them. By mid-afternoon, family members have moved from the fellowship hall into the sanctuary. Sunlight filters through the stained glass windows behind the pulpit, casting a diaphanous veil of color throughout the room, as if everything is floating in a fine mist. Faces glow, heads nod, musical instruments glisten. A man behind an electric piano pounds out a rousing gospel melody before engaging the four singers standing next to him, swaying from side to side, hands clapping, one shaking a tambourine in a call and response. "There's something inside of me," the piano player growls in a raspy baritone, followed by joyful voices singing in unison, telling me to go ahead. When the music winds down and the pre-service prayers and announcements begin, something inside of Tasha Laughlin Hall's spirit tells her to switch things up this year. Instead of reminiscing on the history of the church, she decides to pay tribute to some of the folks who helped keep the congregation going into the 21st century. People like Margot, whose research, Tasha reminds the congregation, has helped solidify Strebe's past so that it may endure for future generations of Lassiters, Hills, Smitherins, and Laughlins. People like Tasha's cousin Albert, whom she describes as an unofficial trustee of the church. And people like the 76-year-old man who, according to Tasha, takes care of all the details, cleaning up the church, making sure things work, making sure the lawn is mowed and the cemetery looks nice. "That person," she says, her voice catching with emotion, "is my father, Jerry Laughlin." Jerry steps up to the front of the sanctuary, where Tasha embraces him and presents him with a certificate of excellence. Later, reflecting on the homecoming service, on the 7.5 decades of previous homecoming services that he's attended, Jerry sighs. It's a sigh of satisfaction that the church in which he grew up, surrounded by so much history and so much love among so many different kinds of people, is still going. It's also a bittersweet sigh of longing for a time at Strebe when every Sunday was a homecoming. And now I don't think we're going to have much time to read anything else, so I'm going to look at some of the ads that I've been passing over as I flipped the page in this article. Here's one that says, "Our wild family is growing." There's a picture of some monkeys, and I guess that's a giraffe, and some sand cat kittens, and a baby chimp. "Swing by the world's largest natural habitat zoo this summer to meet our newest family members and get a sneak peek at our Asia expansion progress. North Carolina Zoo, discover us in Asheville." And one more, "Inspiring awe since 1849, explore boom, get your awe back.com. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.